executing in such a way that you are being mindful of the velocity of money, I think is like the magic formula there. And it's a hard balance to strike. And a lot of people struggle with that, that are raising money to take down real estate deals. But if you can do that, then you're going to put yourself in a good spot and you're going to be in a better spot than a lot of operators and sponsors out there.
If you have over $200,000 sitting stagnant in your bank, retirement account, or home equity, then you're literally losing money. On this show, you learn how to get that money working for you consistently and conservatively. Learn to grow your nest egg with your host, Sean Winslow. Let's dive in.
Welcome back to another Multifamily Monday episode. I'm your host, Sean Winslow, and this is the Multifamily Money Podcast. What's going on, everyone? I got another great episode for you today. Great guest. But before I get into that, I just want to give a shout out to a recent rating and review. This comes from Trevor Oldham. I hope I'm saying that right. Oldham says, awesome. 5 stars. One of my new fave podcasts. Sean is the best. Well, Trevor, I really appreciate that. And guys, as always, I don't make any money off the show. The only fee is one. If you found any value out of this, please, please share this with someone who you think can get value. Share it on your socials, wherever that may be. It's something we'll grow just to get more eyes and ears on the show. And then two, if you have it, leave a rating and review. Apple loves that for their algorithm. That's how we get in front of, also another way we get in front of other people. So if you could take the time to do that, it'd be awesome. Well, let's get back to it. And that is an interview with a returning guest. I believe the first returning guest we've ever had on this show. So shout out to this individual. And that is Axel Ragnarsson. Axel is also a fellow New England real estate investor. And that's kind of how we originally connected. For whatever reason, it seems to be very rare that you find others in New England that do this. It seems like a lot of people are either Texas, Midwest, Southeast, West Coast, and Rockies, but it seems like it's never in New England. So we connected on that. But today, what Axel and I are going to be talking about, what we intended it to be about was creative financing, but we ended up getting into a lot of other things as well. But when I say the term creative financing, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, just think of traditional financing for a property, right? You get a lender, whether that be your traditional lender like a bank, or maybe it's hard money from, you know, an individual. They give you loan to value up to 80% of the property, and then you bring 20% for a down payment plus any closing costs and operating cash that you may need to bring, right? That's traditional financing. That's how you traditionally take down a property. However, the term creative financing, what they mean by that is being creative in how you finance the property. So you don't have to just use that traditional, here's the loan, here's my down payment. We're going to get into what those are. I don't really want to take any steam away from Axel, but he goes over 3 main ones that he's implemented, and he's implemented when he started out and he continues to implement them today. And this is a great way how you can start your investing career, whether you have the cash to do so or not. We talk about that at the beginning of the show, how to grow and scale a portfolio of multifamily real estate through creative financing. And then we get into a lot of different things. Where's the market going? Specifically from an operations standpoint, a lot of people were benefactors of the crazy appreciation we saw in the market over the last few years. And that's not going to continue. We all know that. Inflation's crazy high. Just the beginning of when I hit record on this podcast with Axel, news came out that they raised rates again. Obviously, we knew they were going to do that. In uncertain times, rates are rising, inflation is still rising, and they're trying to raise rates to combat and temper that inflation. And so far, it hasn't done the trick. We're about to find out whether we had positive or negative GDP growth. For a negative, that's for a second consecutive quarter. And traditionally, historically, that's the definition of a recession. So we're about to enter a recession. There's a lot of geopolitical risk. There's just a lot of uncertainty. So the point of this is going forward, we're not going to be able to just rely on crazy appreciation. It's going to come down to one, as Axel points out, buying right, but then two, operations. So we talk a lot about operations because Axel is a great operator. He has a vertically integrated property management company. He started off small and scaled up like most great operators do. And so we talk about what you should be doing in the near future to kind of get through these choppy waters. Then we talk about the business in general and a really solid show. One of the best we've had. And it's one of the ones that I know you're going to take some notes. So buckle up. You're in for a good one. Without further ado, here is Axel. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Sean, how are we doing? I appreciate the invite to come back on.
Good, man. Hey, I could foresee you coming on a few times, man. You bring a lot to the table. And we were just actually talking, breaking news. Fed just raised rates again, 75 basis points. So we're about to have some more fun.
Strap in, folks.
Yeah, right.
Fasten the seatbelts. We're going to hit a little turbulence. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's not the reason we're here, but I'm sure you'll allude to it and how you've been managing your business, because I think what a lot of people forget that this is a business and stuff like this comes up and it's not just managing a per deal basis, but your business through these times. Do you wouldn't mind just giving an update on your business? I think I had you on, I want to say fall of 21. So I'm sure a lot's changed since then. So if you don't mind just giving us an update.
Yeah, absolutely. So fall of 21, I mean, we're recording this end of July. So that's whatever it is, 9 months ago, something like that. So
yeah.
I guess a good amount has changed since then, or a decent amount. But just in case there's somebody with us here that doesn't know me or my story, the Spark Notes, right? Live in Boston, born and raised in New Hampshire. So I've always been in the Northeast. It's part of the reason that you and I connected here, Sean, both being New Hampshire guys. It's pretty rare to find that nowadays.
It is.
But long story short, I got into the business in college, started buying the small multifamily type projects, basically rolled one deal into the next, and 3-4 years kind of had a portfolio that replaced the income. And then I started getting serious about buying larger deals, raising capital, and then also buying out of state, right? And out of state for me was outside of the New Hampshire area. So started buying some deals down in Florida. And if the last time we spoke was in fall, or in the fall of 21, that's right around the time that we started to buy more deals out of state. I think we had a couple deals done in Florida at that point, in Central Florida, a couple of smaller multis, a 16 and a 28 unit. We're probably just about to close a deal out in Indianapolis, which we still own and close around that time frame. And that's also the time frame where starting to get a little bit more serious about raising investor capital. And I'd worked with investors before, but mainly in a joint venture capacity. I'd never really syndicated deals. And I hadn't really worked with the quote unquote traditional passive investor, somebody that's investing 25, 50, 100 grand and basically just taking a step into the backseat, so to speak, and letting the sponsor run the show. All of the deals I had done with investors were more joint ventures where I'm raising larger chunks of capital and they maybe have some operational experience that they could lend to a deal, but hadn't really raised capital from the passive investor type of person. So that's really what's been happening in the business, in my business, the last 9 months. We've done a couple of larger projects since then where we've raised capital, a couple of deals in Florida, a big portfolio in New Hampshire. And we actually just closed a couple of months ago, a 48 unit in Central Florida, which was my first true syndication where I was a lead sponsor. I'd co-sponsored a lot of other deals, but that was one where found the deal, put together the capital, put together the PPM, raised it all, and now we're operating it. And long story short, our business now consists of about 300 or so doors kind of spread across New Hampshire and then in Central Florida. We own a property management company in New Hampshire. We're vertically integrated. That company called Blue Door Living manages about 300 units itself. So about half being my own personal portfolio, the other half being some third-party management. And that business is growing really quickly. And I also host a podcast, the Multifamily Wealth Podcast, which I've been doing for over 2 years now, which feels like it's been even longer than that. But my COVID project has made it through really the peak COVID year. So that's going really well as well. So that's really the high-level update. A few hundred doors, starting to raise some capital and getting real serious about that. And here we are.
What he's trying to say, folks, is that he's been busy since last fall.
Yeah, you could say that.
Just crushing it. And well, first, props to you on 2 years of the podcast. I know what it takes to produce something like this. And I just crossed over the year mark. So 1 year for me. So kudos to you for being 2 years. And someone was telling me the other day that once you get to 100 episodes, we're both at that. Once you get to that, you're like in the top, like less than 1% of all podcasts, just based on that. Cause there's a lot of people that start them and they just fizzle out immediately.
It's a labor of love. I mean, at the end of the day, unless you have a really large audience that you're bringing over from some other platform and you have a big listener base to your podcast, unless that's what you're doing, it's definitely a labor of love and it takes forever to get off the ground. And I really enjoyed it though. It's allowed me to meet people like you. I mean, obviously I had you on my show and the folks that you get to meet and the people that you can connect with just because you hit record on the conversation instead of just not doing that, it's pretty incredible. So I'm sure I'll be doing it for another 2, 4, 10 years because I love the process and I love just having the conversations, but you're right. It's definitely a lot of work.
If you guys didn't pick up on one aspect of Axel's story when he was given the cliff notes there, is that he started really young doing this, like right out of college. And he talked about buying one deal, rolling into the next, then rolling into the next. And that's how he started off and grew what he has now. And one aspect of that I'll hit on is I feel that the truly great operators, that's how they started. The ones that have kind of like just jumped in head first. Not there's anything wrong with this. There's a place for everyone in this game, for capital raisers and all that. But the ones that kind of just jump in head first, kudos to them. But I feel like they don't have the staying power that someone has starting from the ground up. Because trust me, I know this, when you start with the small ones, you see a lot of things that you may not see when you're taking on a big project because you're involved with everything day in and day out. So one, I know that's why Axel will be around here for a long time. But I think what I want to talk about today with you, Axel, is like, how did you do that? Because obviously we've spoke, you're not like a son of a billionaire or anything. So like, how are you taking all these, at least you haven't said that to me.
I'm not, for the record. I wish. We wouldn't have to talk about everything we're probably going to talk about here. Yeah. So
how'd you do it, man? Like, you know, people have heard the term creative financing. Like, what does that mean? And like, have you actually been able to take these deals down? And I know it looks different now, but how did you do that from the beginning?
Absolutely. I mean, the strategies I was using in the beginning, we're still using now. And whether you're doing deals yourself, where you're just the person buying it, or you're raising capital and doing deals, these strategies can be utilized in both situations, because the whole objective, at least for me in real estate, is to maintain the velocity of money. We all get into real estate because we like cash flow. We like passive income. It has its tax advantages. And those are all great. But the real money in real estate is made from buying great deals, creatively structuring them, getting your cash out and doing it again. Like, those are the actions that create the returns, fundamentally speaking. And all of the other stuff is great and it matters, but that's really what makes the money, right? That's what drives returns. That's what grows a portfolio. And if you get really good at that, you can really compress the timeline to growing a portfolio. So I'll just kind of touch on three strategies I've used. And if we want to use, like, you know, examples, I can talk about deals where I've used them. We can maybe get into that. But fundamentally speaking, there's three main ones, and then I'll touch on a fourth. But the first one that is really underutilized is just the concept of using a seller credit. And most people understand seller credits as it relates to get a property under contract. It's got some physical deficiencies, right? And maybe you find out some more stuff during inspections and you ask the seller to give you a credit at closing to go fix a roof or to go change an electric panel or whatever, right? So that concept can be applied without actually having there to be a need for a seller credit, so to speak. So for me, when I was getting started, I wanted to bring as little cash as I could to closing. I wanted to minimize my cash out of pocket because that ties into the concept of the velocity of money. Bring less cash. You can therefore spread your cash across more deals and you can basically do more in a faster period of time. So for example's sake, let's say you have a property under contract at 400 grand and I could use 4 million, right? It's the same fundamental concept, right? But just 400 grand, just because the numbers are easy in my head. And you're going to go to a bank, they're going to give you 75% loan to value. That's 300 grand. So you got to bring 100 grand to close this deal. Very simplified. We're not talking closing costs. Very simplified example. But if you want to bring less money to closing, let's say you go out there and you speak with the seller, you speak with the broker representing the seller, and you present an offer at 450 with a $50,000 seller credit. So the seller is still walking away with 400 grand. He's still getting his price. But in that situation, you're getting a credit for $50,000 at closing. Now, what is 75% loan to value of 450? It's 330 and change or something like that, right? My mental math is probably a little tough, but it's right around that figure. And you're going to have to bring, call it 112 to closing. So if there wasn't that seller credit, you're bringing a little bit more money to closing. But when you actually get to closing, you look at the closing statement and there's $50,000 being credited to the buyer. Your cash out of pocket goes from being 112 down to 62, right? So you're fundamentally bringing less to closing in this hypothetical scenario. And that was something that I used quite a bit early on. And it's important to understand the fundamental, basically what you need to do before you can put this to work is find a good deal. Like, you have to find a good deal, right? And that's going to be kind of the constant here. And if you don't have a good deal that you're not buying below market value day one, it's going to be really hard to use a lot of the things I'm talking about. But in this scenario, you have to make sure the lender's on board with it, right? That they're okay with you picking up a credit like that. You're going to have to explain it to the seller and maybe they ask you for a little bit of higher purchase price or something like that to accommodate for the additional transfer taxes, which are marginal in these situations typically. But long story short, to be a little bit more brief here, it's reducing the money you have to bring to closing. And I did this on every single deal I did for years. That's how I made offers. I was like, property's worth 500. I'm going to get it under contract at 4 because I did all the really hard stuff to get in front of this seller, direct mail, cold calling, all this stuff. I'm going to offer 450 with a $50,000 credit because I know I want to pay 400. And sometimes the seller says no, and maybe you deviate and you just go use a traditional structure. But oftentimes sellers are like, yeah, that's weird, but okay. And the benefit of not having to bring as much to closing. So that's kind of number one. And then I can get to the other ones if you want me to just keep ripping through. But
yeah. A few questions because that is powerful. And personally, I have not used that strategy yet, but it's something I've always thought of. It's a great strategy. But my question is, could you use this with a traditional lender? And if so, it's just something about being transparent with them and letting them know?
Yeah, I think it's important to be transparent. I don't know how many listeners are looking to go owner-occupy properties, for example, and use like an FHA loan or some kind of conventional loan. The requirements on those from an underwriting perspective are much more strict. FHA definitely has caps, right? But in the world of commercial real estate, a lot of what a lender will allow you to do is based on what you can convince them to let you to do, right? There's less black and white requirements, and it's much more of a conversational art as you're putting together deals. So for example, we just did a 48 unit deal in Central Florida, the one that I closed a couple months ago. You and I were talking about a little bit before you hit record. That property kind of knew I wanted my price to be around 2.5 for this deal. And I approached it through the lens of, all right, I want to pick up a little bit of a seller credit here, right? Because I want to reduce my raise, right? And this is, it's reducing my cash out of pocket. But in this deal where I was raising capital, it's reducing the amount of capital that I fundamentally have to raise, which makes my life a lot easier. And therefore, it makes the returns for our investors a lot easier, better, I should say. So I approached him. I said, all right, I'll give you 2.7 with a $200,000 seller credit. And he understood the concept. He's a smart guy. He's like, he knew that that was going to net out 250. And we started kind of getting into a little bit of a conversational dance. But that was a fundamental component of the negotiation process was me. It was like, no, I want this seller credit. And eventually we settled on a number where I was picking up about $192,000 seller credit. I was paying a little bit more than 2.5 when we were done our negotiations. But that was had an immense value to me. And the lender on that was a bridge lender, national bridge lender, does business everywhere. They're based out of New York. And it's not like they're not a very sophisticated, intelligent lender. They look at it. They know exactly what I'm trying to do. But I was like, hey, we're still bringing a lot of equity to this deal. I escrowed a few more months worth of interest. And as a net at the end of the day, it was a win. I brought about $120,000 less to closing, right? And we had to raise about that $120,000 less and made that process a lot easier. So this is something that you can do no matter if you're raising capital, no matter what, right? It's just a matter of having a conversation with the lender. And private lenders, hard money lenders, bridge lenders, they're going to be receptive to this. If you're dealing with conventional lenders, local banks, local credit unions, maybe a Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac product, if you're talking multifamily, you may have to jump through some more hoops, but it's worth just asking and having the conversation. And if anything, you get into a contract, the lender doesn't like it, just tweak the contract, right? And then you're back to where you would have started anyways.
Yeah. And I think that's with anything that with terms of lenders, terms, rates, it's all negotiable to a certain point, right? I think, especially people starting out, they'll get like, hey, I even did it when I was first starting out. You get a term sheet and you think that's okay, this is what it is. But there's always a little pushback, right? You can negotiate rates, terms. It's just like anything. They're trying to sell something and get the most out of it. So they're going to put their best foot forward first, but there's always room for negotiation. So that's a good point. Don't forget that you can negotiate all these things. All right, what's the second one?
Number two, and again, right, in the our whole goal is bringing less cash to closing. And the way to do that is to use a second mortgage. And people hear second mortgage, they get spooked and they think, oh, you're over leveraging a deal. It's risky. 2009, 2010, everybody lost their shirt. Yes, that's all true, right? It's all true if you're paying market value for a deal and then taking out a second mortgage and you're 100% leveraged to the current value of the property. Again, we tie back to the comment I made a couple minutes ago. This is all contingent upon getting a good deal in a contract. So to go back to that example, right? Let's say you got a $400,000 deal that's worth five. You're buying it at 80% of market value or whatever that is. And basically, if a lender gives you 75% of your purchase price, which is what they do, they lend based on your purchase price. They don't lend on the current value. They lend on what you have in a contract. That would be, let's say they give you 75%. That's 300 grand. You have to bring 100 grand to closing. Now, let's say you want to bring less and you got an investor that is willing to put a second mortgage on this property. And maybe they're a little bit spooked about doing that because they don't like the idea of being in second position on a deal that's heavily mortgaged or heavily leveraged. But you say, hey, I'm buying this at four. First, the bank's giving me three, but it's worth 500, right? And here's a desktop appraisal, or here's the appraisal from when we were doing our first position underwriting, right? When that bank had the appraisal done. Look, it says it's worth 500, right? We have all this data to support that. So even if you were to put a $75,000 mortgage on this property in a second position, it's still only a $375,000 loan balance on a $500,000 property. That's reasonable leverage, right? For most people with a normal risk profile. So if you find a good deal and you're buying it at such a discount that you can take on a little bit more debt in a second position capacity and still not be over leveraged because the deal is worth more than what you're paying for it, I don't know, it's something you should probably explore. So again, we want to bring less money to deals because that's what really juices our returns and that's what allows us to grow a portfolio quickly. And that helps you do that.
Goes to your point of velocity of money. Got to keep it working. So if you can bring less, then you can put more out. I might have missed this, but who are you using in that second position? Can it be the seller?
could be the seller. I've done that once before. I've usually found that that's a good route to go. This is, again, another situation where it's entirely contingent upon who the first position lender is and what they're willing to allow.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard of a lot of investors just doing it, right? Don't do that, right? Don't be the guy that puts your first position lender in the dark, because that really kills your relationship and can put you in a tough spot. But let's say you chat with the first position lender and you say, hey, I have an investor that's willing to extend a second mortgage here. Is this something that's okay with you guys? And the bank's probably going to go and make sure that it still meets debt service coverage ratio requirements. They're going to make sure that their first position loan is not in jeopardy because the deal is servicing too much debt. You know, they might do some underwriting. Maybe they'll just say no and you can't do it.
Right.
Or maybe they say, yeah, but with this parameters. Okay, well, then you can go do it. I've found that this works really, really well on smaller properties, especially where the first position lender is either a seller, right? Maybe the seller is holding the first position and they don't have a bank, they don't have investment committee to answer to, or the first position lender is a hard money lender, a private lender, you know, maybe an individual, maybe it's a bridge lender and they have a little bit more of a flexible criteria. And again, it's just what you can negotiate, what the conversation that you can have with that lender. I've bought deals that were at such a discount that local credit unions, who are, I've found, are typically against this type of structure, they're okay with it because they're like, yeah, we see you're buying this at such a discount, but we're okay with this. For example, yeah. I bought a 24 unit portfolio and had under the contract at 1.8 and it was worth like 2.4, like could have closed and resold it for 2.4. And the appraisals reflected that. And I said, hey, I want a $200,000 second mortgage on this. I have an investor that I'm going to pay 10% monthly interest to and a couple of points. And they're like, yeah, that's fine. Debt service coverage makes sense. We value you as a borrower. You're well qualified. We've done a lot of business together, blah, blah, blah. And that's how we actually closed that deal. So again, it's just a matter of having these conversations and learning what you can do, but understanding that the structure is there to utilize.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it just goes to your point. It's just being creative and finding a way to make it work and being transparent along the way. Because at the end of the day, this business is about relationships. And now that you've built that relationship with that lender specifically, I'm sure they bent over backwards just to keep doing business with you. All right, what's number three?
Number three is using some kind of investor buyout option, right? And I think this is a tricky one to kind of quickly explain. And the big asterisk is like, I'm not an attorney, right? Whenever you're raising capital, you got to go speak with an attorney to do it the right way, to do it in a compliant way. But from a conceptual application standpoint, something that we've done a lot is raise capital in the form of preferred equity, right? In a share class where you pay a preferred return, which is basically a non-guaranteed rate of return for that group of investors. And we structure the deal in such a way to where they're treated preferentially to me, the sponsor, or to the sponsors if there's multiple sponsors. And the first, call it 11, 12, 13% of the distributions from the deal, whether it's cash flow or upon sale, go to that group of individuals. So it oftentimes acts very similar to a second mortgage. However, you're not recording a lien on the property at closing. This is a way to alleviate a lot of the uncomfortable conversations that you can have when you're trying to go the second mortgage out, for example, with a primary lender. It's also a way to crowdsource more capital, right? Crowdsource is maybe not the right word to use because it's not like technically crowdsourcing, but to bring in multiple investors with smaller dollar amounts to arrive at maybe a larger amount of capital. So for example, we do deals oftentimes when we're syndicating where we have Class A shares of 12% preferred return with no share in the upside. And then we have Class B, 8 or 9% preferred return, 50-50 split, 60-40 split, something like that, which is kind of a more traditional syndication structure.
Yep.
But a lot of investors are risk averse and they'd rather invest in the Class A, earn that 1% a month on their money, 12% a year. And again, it's non-guaranteed, right? You don't have a lien against the property, but within the operating agreement and the structure of that deal, those investors are treated preferentially. And again, whenever you're raising capital, make sure you're doing it in a compliant way and go speak with your attorney about this, right? And what I'm describing might not be possible for folks listening, but I think understanding that structure is really, really helpful because it gets you around a couple of the other things in terms of second mortgage limitations, right? That some lenders might have.
And where have you seen kind of like the breakdown of investors who want Class A, who want Class B?
I usually, in our deals, and this is a small sample size because we've just started doing this really like intentionally and marketing deals with these classes, but usually we find maybe 25% of the investors want to be in that Class A, maybe 30%. The other 75% want to be in Class B. They want a share of that upside. It really depends on who your investor base is. This is a very broad statement, but if your investor is a 30-year-old tech employee, for example, who has a long time horizon, they're slightly higher tolerance for risk. They like the idea of investing in real estate because of the cash flow and the fact that the risk-adjusted returns make a lot of sense, but they want to share in the upside. They're probably going to be, you know, class B, traditional investor in a syndication structure. Let's say you're on the other side of that spectrum, right? You get a 65-year-old attorney who is looking to retire in 5 years. They might be more interested in the class A option, right? Something that's a little bit more guaranteed. And again, none of this is guaranteed in terms of when you're investing in equity, the success is really contingent upon how the project goes and how the market performs and everything like that. You don't have a lien against the property, but you are treated preferentially on the capital stack. So it depends on who your investors are. My investors tend to be younger folks just because that's my personal network. So I find more people are looking to invest in the other class. But again, every once in a while, you get someone that's interested in that other option.
I think it's great to have those options just in general, because when I talk to investors, you're right. It really depends who they are and what they're looking for. People will be like, this one kind of, not that it's guaranteed, but like, I know I'm getting this return on my money. And then others are like, no, I need the upside. I want the upside. So I think it's really cool to be able to offer both, because I feel like there's a lot of syndications out there that don't do that. It's like, this is what it is, whether it's just like a straight split or there's some type of waterfall, but there's not that option to be both. Also, I think it allows more flexibility for the deal itself too, right? At least I've seen it that way, where you kind of get flexible with how you're structuring it. You can provide more what I call like a buffer to make the deal a little fatter. I don't know if you see that, but when we structure it, it makes it seem like a win-win for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think people like options, right? And I think that in our business now, where we're syndicating deals, right? We're putting together large chunks of equity from a lot of different individuals. We like to have an option for multiple different folks who have different risk profiles, who have different return requirements, who want to invest in real estate for different reasons, right? I think in the world of raising capital, it's really understand that not everybody has the same goals. Me as a 27-year-old guy who's not married and doesn't have kids, like my risk profile is insanely different than somebody who's got a family, right? And they're really just looking for consistent distributions. And that's why they'd rather get some of their money out of the stock market. They could be enamored with the upside potential in a deal, but like, they're like, hey, if I can invest 100 grand and I can earn 12K a year if the property performs and I'm treated preferentially to other folks in the deal, that's of interest to me. So I think it really depends. And you know, for me, my risk profile, I should say with an asterisk, right? Like when I'm bringing investor capital in a deal, like I'm very risk averse and I'd rather raise enough capital to be able to service the investor preferred return from the get-go, right? I don't like doing deals that are contingent upon quickly executing a business plan and then quickly getting back to catching up on a preferred return. I'd rather raise that capital up front. And I say that to illustrate the importance of that. If you're going to go the route of raising some kind of preferred class of share, preferred equity, because oftentimes those people that are investing in that share, they don't like the idea of, oh, you're going to catch up 9 months into the deal or 12 months into the deal. Like they're doing that because they want those consistent distributions. Like that's the value add there. So you have to kind of go into a deal like that, knowing you need to raise more money up front to be able to service that.
Glad you brought that up. So I was talking about this on another podcast where investors, when it says a preferred return, you really need to look into the, you know, the fine print and what does that mean? Because it's one thing where it's you're getting a 7-8 pref, but are you getting that from day one? Or is it there like Axel said, a catch-up period? Because what I've seen a lot of other deals, it's the catch-up period, 1-2% in the first couple of years. And then it's a catch-up that'll bring you to average out to that 7-8%. So, and to your point of raising extra, I agree with you. Depending on the size of the deal, we'll bring an extra 300,000 just to have a little extra operating cash, because you never know what's going to happen. It could be to service a preferred return. Something could come up where we need just some extra cash. If you're getting your CapEx finance, that's a big thing. If you're getting CapEx finance, bring some operating cash, because getting a draw from a bank can take forever.
Yes.
And if they're not able to pay vendors, that pisses them off and then the vendors are going to disappear. And that slows everything down.
It's funny that you mentioned that, right? Because throughout this whole conversation that you and I have just had, right, I've talked about how important the velocity of money is and how when you're doing deals yourself, you want to bring as little cash to closing as possible and you want to really make your dollar stretch. And then as you start to raise money and start to progress to that side of the business and of your career, like you have to flip that mindset in a way into where you want to use as little cash in the actual deal itself, but you need to have a lot of cash in the operating account on hand.
Yeah.
Do not put yourself in a bad spot. So most sponsors, this is what I find, and I'm constantly speaking with people that are looking to scale their business, looking to raise capital for the first time, looking to do larger deals. And they're just trying to raise the least amount of money, because on the spreadsheet, raising that small amount of money is what creates the nice IRR in Excel. But in reality, like, that is such a stressful way to operate a business. Like, we've raised capital for a number of deals now, and I am so much more comfortable in the deals where we have so much money that, like, we can tear through a business plan. Like, I'm not worried about preferred returns in terms of, like, staying current with them. I'm not worried about, like, running out of cash. I'm not worried about having to make a personal contribution. Like, just the peace of mind that comes with raising more money than you need, but also executing in such a way that you are being mindful of the velocity of money, I think is, like, the magic formula there. And it's a hard balance to strike. And a lot of people struggle with that are raising money to take down real estate deals. But if you can do that, then you're going to put yourself in a good spot, and you're going to be in a better spot than a lot of operators and sponsors out there.
Yeah. And I didn't plan on talking about operations today, but I think it would be stupid not to, just because you're such a great operator. The times we're heading into, I feel like the Warren Buffett quote, "Your tide goes out, we see who's swimming naked." And I feel we're going to see a lot of that in the coming, whatever, 6 to 24 months, whatever it happens to be. I think it's solely going to come down to a lot of things, but one major thing, and that's operations. Like, if you bought poorly, a price point or type of debt you put on it, yeah. But, like, if you're a good lender, you can kind of get yourself through that. But if you're, if you're a good operator, you can kind of get yourself through that. But if you're not, there's going to be some rough waters ahead. I just want to get your thought on that and what you're doing, if you're changing anything at all in terms of operations going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that while it's not operations, it's a lot easier when you buy the right deal. I feel compelled to make that comment, because I think there's a bit of, I don't want to call it a cliche, but there's a common statement out there where a bad operator can ruin a great deal and a great operator can make a mediocre deal look great. And that's true. I do believe that. But I think it's just so much easier to just buy right. And then the rest of this really starts to take care of itself. But from an operational standpoint, I think the days of the sponsor that comes out of a mentorship group, buys a deal, hands the keys to the third-party property management company and checks in once a month, those days are over. Like, that's not going to cut it anymore, because we're getting to a period of time where managing vacancy, managing delinquencies, managing your CapEx budget efficiently, effectively overseeing your property management company, staffing your properties correctly and in the right way, managing your utility spend, like, all of these things, everyone's going to really need a magnifying glass on each component of the asset management process there. And I'll be the first to admit, I struggled early in my career with operations. I didn't struggle in terms of, I had, like, real problems with it, but I didn't realize how important it was to just stay organized and to be detail oriented. And if you aren't that type of person, then you need somebody on your team that is. And those naturally aren't my skill sets, but I have people around me and people in our business and people on my team that are very detail oriented. And I have joint venture partners in our deals where we have multiple brains on one common goal. And I think that's going to be a big separator for groups moving forward, is I think being, like, a solo operator, investor, capital, like, one guy doing everything, one girl doing everything is going to be, like, if I'm a passive investor, I don't want to work with guys like that, companies like that, whoever, because there's so much risk in the operator who's trying to put together the investor updates, do asset management, look for the next deal, manage their social media account, and they're spreading themselves too thin, and they don't have enough time to get on a weekly call with their property management company, discuss the really important metrics, follow up on that call 4 or 5 days later with notes from the call following up. Hey, were these action items taken care of? Did we do these things? Did we bid this project? And just being, like, maniacally kind of hovering over the property management company. Like, that's what needs to be done. And I also think that right now, a lot of folks are going to start to see the value in integrating different components of the process into their business. We have property management vertically integrated up in New Hampshire. We don't have it integrated down in Florida because we have an unbelievable third-party management company, and it's takes a whole hell of a lot of work to vertically integrate management. And so we're taking it one market at a time, but we've done it in New Hampshire. And the benefit that we get from having maintenance folks on payroll, that we have from having a leasing agent on payroll, that we have from having a property manager on payroll, that we get from being able to bulk buy materials and to do all of these different things, we can save so much money in all of these different components of the process because we have that infrastructure developed, which puts us at such an advantage to the other investors there that are just buying a deal and then going and handing the keys to somebody else. Yeah. And just hoping that they do a good job. And even the best asset managers who are overseeing good third-party management companies, there's naturally going to be more cost and inefficiency there than to have everybody under the same roof working for the same team. So I think that I'm kind of just kind of riff there. I don't even know if I got to an actionable point or anything or answered your question, but that's just kind of what I'm thinking about, is what's going to become more important in the short term here as we've round out the rest of this year.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, because at the end of the day, no one's going to love your property like you do. They're in the business to manage it, but they could have thousands of other units and they're just there to make a dollar like you are. So How do they make a dollar? By charging you more fees and limiting the amount of time that they on that property, right? Increase revenue, reduce expenses. And expenses for them is to have manpower on there longer than they need. And I think to your point of the meetings, that's huge. So we have 1 week, we'll have a meeting with our construction management team and our property management team together. And then the next week, it'll just be the property management company. And then, so that's how we run it. And to your point, you've got to stay on top of these people. And it's not that they don't care or don't want to do a good job. It's just the fact there's a lot of details. And at the end of the day, you need to drive this, let them know where you want to go and stay on top. Asset management to me is kind of like babysitting.
It really is. I think that's a good, I mean, that's fundamentally the word for it. And a very small component of our process that's really important that I'm just going to mention, and it's silly that I feel silly even mentioning it because it's so simple, is take notes. Just take notes on your asset management calls. We can verbally have a conversation, right? And set the expectation with your property management company too. Like, I want you at a desk so that if I have a question about a report, like you can pull it up. You can pull up the property management software. I don't want you out in the field taking a call in the backyard somewhere. Like, oh yeah, I think Johnny's out to quote that project. Like, I set the expectation. Like, I really do want you at a desk. And if you can't do it every time, I understand. But that's really the objective. And on this call, I'm going to record it. And I'm going to take notes or have someone on your team take notes and say, these are the specific bullet point items that we need to do. This is who's responsible for taking care of which part of it. And then I make a note in my calendar to follow up 3 days later. So we have our asset management calls on Tuesday. And then on Friday, I follow up in the morning on all of these points. Was this taken care of? Was this taken care of? Was that taken care of? Where are we at on this open item? And it's like, it's such a little tiny tweak in the process, but just getting on the phone verbally each week is still going to put you kind of ahead. But like, you need a system to hold property management companies accountable, to hold GCs accountable. So it's a little suggestion that some people might be like, duh. But I know a lot of people that don't do that, right? And it makes all of that work so much more more hard, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
And you're right. It's so simple, but it's really necessary. The recording part is a good point. We haven't done that. And that's something that maybe I will do. What we do is we do have someone on the team take notes and then send out an email. So then to everyone. So everyone gets it. This is what we talked about. This is what we discussed. This is your action item. This is mine. And then we can reference it on a future call if it's obviously not taken care of. Hey, you said this is your job. It's not done. And you said it's not to call anyone out, but everyone needs to be held accountable, especially when we're raising capital. Like, it's one thing if it's just my deal. I'm still going to operate it like I'm operating anything else. But at the end of the day, if I'm operating a deal with someone else's money, like, my fiduciary duty to do whatever I can to make sure it goes smoothly.
Yeah. And you know, it's raising money is really stressful, right? And it took me forever to raise capital because I was so stressed out about even just asking someone if they wanted to invest in a deal. And now that even I'm a little bit more okay with it, I still get so stressed out when like we close a deal and there's just a lot of money that isn't mine on the line and mine as well. But like, it's just anything that you can do to alleviate that stress will make your life obviously easier, but will also make running your business a lot easier, right? And a lot of what we talked about today does that, where raise more than you need, have a really good operations process. Don't let the operations get away from you. I've let that happen in a couple of deals where I didn't have investors and it was just my money. There were smaller deals and checked in, but I was just like, I didn't feel in control of that process.
And it gets away really fast too. I've had it happen to me.
If you lapse for a couple weeks, a few weeks, next thing you know, you're behind, right? It takes is 1 month for your delinquencies to spike a little bit.
Oh yeah.
And it causes a cascading waterfall of events. 2 months later, you're like, geez, what the hell happened? And so it's tough, but it's part of the business. You really have to stay on top of that. And if that's not your forte, like at all, then find someone that it is their forte.
Right.
Have them own that process, right? But I think it's just an important concept to understand, especially when the market starts to get tough and you're not going to get bailed out by the market appreciating, which literally like just a fifth grader could have bought a massive portfolio of property in South Florida 2 years ago and never talked to the property management company. They would have made a ton of money when they sold it last year.
Made a tweet on that today.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think I mentioned it too in emails newsletter that I do. I was like, if trained monkeys could have been buying properties the last couple of years and they would have cleaned up. But when the rents start to stagnate and the construction prices start to go up and the property taxes, insurance, and all that stuff starts to go up and the cap rates are flatlining, if not even going up a little bit, like that's the difference. Operations is the difference.
100%. And especially actually like where we are now with inflation's just hitting everything. And the type of assets you and I invest in, B and C class assets, you know, those people are getting pinched the most. And so that's what I'm worried about. Cause you still see people like project, which I don't know why they're doing this, makes me scared for them, but projecting crazy rent growth. And it's like, even if you can get that, there gets to a point where your end user, your resident can simply not afford that. And they're going to have to make a choice. Do I use this money to pay for food, fuel to get to my job, or rent? And I guarantee that rent will be the third one on that list because they need to eat. They need to get to work so they can have the money to pay for the food.
Mm-hmm.
That just makes me scared how people are still have these crazy rent growth assumptions.
I mean, it's tough. I think his name is Jay Parsons. He's economist for like RealPage or something like that. And I believe that's what he is. He always pops up on my LinkedIn feed. And he shares really, really compelling graphs and data and everything like that. And I really enjoy his content. Here I am saying, I don't even know his name. I think it's Jay Parsons. But long story short, he shared a graphic like a week ago. This is mid-July. And it basically included the collections rates for Class A, Class B, and Class C apartment communities. Class A held strong from 2018, 2019 through the pandemic into 21 and 22. Class B held really strong, kind of dipped like about a percentage point, like really nothing meaningful during the pandemic and then really up until the last couple of months. Class C, 85, 88, 89 through the pandemic. And then it was the only one where there was a significant drop in the collections rate the last 12 months.
Yep.
And it was clear Class A and Class B holding strong. Class C, no, starting to suffer. And it was like, we have tons of data to support this. So if you're doing Class C investing, like your collections are going to go down. Like that's going to happen because just as you just mentioned, Sean, there's no realistic scenario in which a Class C resident is going to pay their rent before they put food on the table, put gas in their car so they can get to their job, and even buy presents for the kids at Christmas. If you don't pay a rent, you got 60 days at least to figure it out in most markets. In some markets, you got like 6 months, right? Yeah. But like you have time to figure that out and to catch up. So I think that's where we're going to start to see some pain. And the good operators who are able to really structure creative payment plans, right? To provide maybe some short-term relief to retain physical occupancy and get that economic occupancy back up. Those are the people that are going to start to thrive here. So I just wanted to point that out because it's funny you mentioned that because I just saw like really hard data recently that just supported what you were saying.
Yeah, that's the thing that's been worrying me because everyone talks about like, oh, rent growth, it's so great, tracks inflation. But yeah, it does. But it gets to a point where people just simply can't afford it. And that's a huge brick wall we can't get around. I'm going to be cognizant of your time. We're coming up the top of the hour. I don't know if you have much more, but if not, we can just...
Yeah, I got some time, man. Whatever you want to touch on, I'm here.
Yeah. Not too much longer. We're talking about raising capital, obviously, because that's a huge part of the deal. And, you know, putting out these pro formas, had a recent raise. Like, what are you seeing from an investor standpoint? I've heard we haven't done a raise in a couple months now for a deal. So I haven't seen it recently, but I've heard that there's a slowdown. Have you seen that? And then two, what is kind of your business plan going forward?
So I want to preface my answer with capital raising isn't my core competency as a skill set. I'm more of a deal guy. I'm more of an operations guy.
Yeah.
I raise capital to do more of the first two. So for me, while I do it, I'm not in the trenches speaking with sophisticated or successful investors on a day-to-day basis. But what I have realized, or what I have started to come to realize, I should say, over the last, call it month, is most investors are becoming really, really concerned about properties that have long-term business plans or high significant value add if you're doing multifamily or some kind of value add asset class, or basically deals that have a lot of execution risk. So we're trying to look at deals right now that are extremely rinse and repeat in terms of we've invested in this market, we've invested with this property management team, or it's our own property management team. We've done this type of renovation. We've worked with this class of tenant, this class of resident, and we've financed with this lender. Like basically check all the boxes so that there's less surprises than if we were to get into a new market or get into a new product type. So for me, we were really trying to grow our business to only focus on 50 plus unit assets, ideally 100 plus. And I have a long, long, long background in doing small to mid-sized multifamily in New Hampshire, specifically in Manchester, where we have our team. So like, I know the market literally like it's my own backyard. I know it like the back of my hand. And we do a lot of direct-to-seller marketing to owners. And naturally, we come across a lot of smaller deals that are have really compelling pricing because we're the only buyer the seller is talking to. So we said, hey, if we're going to start raising capital, because I like things to be easy, I don't like to have to convince someone to invest money. I want things to be no-brainer for people. I want frictionless work just in terms of day-to-day basis. I don't want to have to be getting into stressful conversations. So I was like, let's take a step back. Let's focus on what we really, really know, which is a small multifamily in New Hampshire. We have four deals under contract right now that are just small multifamily projects in New Hampshire. We're going to be raising capital to buy them in a fund structure, be a 506c fund. And it's very simple. It's we buy these. We have our own team to do the renovations. We have our own team to lease them up. We have our own team to manage them. We know these areas like the back of our hands. I know the rent to within 1% of the rent in terms of, because we're leasing the same exact units with the same finishes on the same street every single week. And those are the projects that I'm interested in. Those are the projects I find my investors are interested in investing in. Smaller projects with less things that can go wrong and that are shorter timelines to execution. These are deals we can turn around in 6 months. We can do some kind of a capital event, assuming the market agrees with us, deliver some cash back through a refinance or a sale. And that's where I think most investors are, at least in my world, are most concerned with. Obviously, they want to see compelling purchase prices, right? Purchase prices that are discounted to market today to account for a correction a little bit, you know, buy with a buffer. They want to, you know, again, that rinse and repeat business model, and they want to see a sponsorship team that's just executed consistently. And I think that if you're out there looking at projects that hit those three bullet points, you're probably going to have a lot easier time raising capital. And outside of that, I think the investors that are concerned about investing in multifamily, even if a sponsor has hit all those three, are probably just concerned beyond the point that you'd be able to convince them to participate in a deal, right? And we don't want to go out and convince people to invest in real estate, right? We want people to want to come and participate in what we're doing. So those are the three check boxes I'm looking to kind of check off, if that makes sense.
Definitely. The riches are in the niches. And I don't think it's just people were just throwing out high IRRs and equity multiples and getting people to invest. And I don't think that's going to be the case, at least not in the near future. You can't just do that. They're really, you know, it's a really like they know you, like you, and trust you. They know that you've done this in the past. And like you could say, it's just rinse and repeat. I think that's definitely the case. There's definitely been some pullback in terms of, you know, people aren't really sure what's going on. Some think, oh, if I wait, it's going to drop even more, be better opportunities. And there's some like, oh, I've lost X in the stock market, so I'm not going to sell now. You'll get all those type of people. But at the end of the day, I think it goes to your point of like, if you have a solid track record and it's easily repeated, you're always going to have a pull from. And also to the point of go after the people that you already know want to invest, not that you have to first convince them to invest in this asset class and then convince them of a certain deal.
Yeah. And I think that it's important to note right now as well, if you're investing in real estate, you need a longer time horizon than you've had the last few years. For anyone that might be listening to this that either knows like my content, I'm a huge proponent of selling real estate. And in the past, we've gotten into deals, we've created a lot of value, we've sold because we want, again, velocity of money. We want to get that cash into more deals. We don't like a low return on equity. A lot of sponsors and sponsor groups don't sell. And there's tons of reasons to not do that. I just happen to do what I know that folks that are investing in my deals would appreciate, which is sometimes taking chips off the table. And if they can turn their 50 into 100 in a year in terms of their investment, great. Yeah, maybe it's not the most tax advantage play. Maybe a refi is a little bit more tax advantaged. But now and then again, we'll sell. We're not married to always refining. So the change I'm having to make is understanding and communicating to investors like, hey, maybe the last few projects you've invested in, we've gotten in and out in a year, and that's kind of what you might be used to. However, that's not 100% going to happen on this opportunity, right? Because we may have to refinance and hold for 3, 4, 5 years until we feel like we're in a good position to exit this and provide a great return to everybody. So I think that understanding time horizon right now is really critical and aligning your debt with the time horizon that you have and then your investors are looking to, I guess that they have as well, I should say, I think is important as well.
Yeah, I think that's a huge factor. It's not like the flipping of apartment buildings is not going to be as prevalent these days. Of course, if you buy right, it still can happen, but on by and large, it's going to be a longer term hold. And on the flip side of that, I think that's also going to bring a lot of opportunities to the table that you can buy it at a good price because people are not going to be able to who bought short-term debt, like bridge debt, they're not going to be able to refinance into something long-term. They're going to have to sell because just how rates have exploded and prices come down a little bit, they're not going to meet that DCR. They're going to need their debt coverage ratio that they're going to need to go into something long-term. So I think they're going to be forced to sell.
Exactly.
That's what I see coming. All right, man. Well, I appreciate your time as always. This has been huge. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of pausing, rewinding, re-listening because there's definitely been some great advice. But before I let you go, I want to ask you a couple questions. One, I know you view this as a business, which I 100% agree with you. I know we've had this conversation before and I've seen you talk about it before in other places too, that you're not just a real estate investor. You know, you got to view this as a business. One, why do you believe that? I know this probably could be its own episode, but as short as you can. And two, what's a good business book or resource that you could recommend to someone?
Yeah, absolutely. So to quickly set the stage, I think that a lot of real estate investors get in the business where because they want to go buy a few duplexes and they want the passive income and they like that, right? And then as they get in the business, they learn more about it. They like it more. And next thing you know, they're trying to buy more deals and buy more deals. And for the people that get into real estate through in that way, which is me, I know that's how a lot of people get into real estate, probably most people, right? More than 50%, the majority. You don't understand that it can become a business with a staff, right? You're just out there trying to do deals and get deals done. And there's a skill set that's required to do that. And there's a skill set that's required to go and build a business, which is an entirely different skill set than just being a deal junkie, right? And for me, I was textbook deal junkie, still am, right? I still am really trying to develop the managerial skills, the leadership skills, the delegation skills to grow an organization. And at some point I realized, like, this is a business like any other business, right? The guy who runs flooring business can't just install his own flooring forever. Like, there's a clear cap on how large that business can get. Yeah. And I started looking around and saying, do I want to be the guy that owns 50, 60 doors forever? And that's kind of where I plateau. And that's a number that I was at when I really started thinking about this. And I was like, I could do that, but I kind of want to grow a larger portfolio and do larger deals. I looked at the people that were doing larger deals and had larger portfolios, and they had an acquisitions individual. They had an assistant. They had an analyst, right? They had an asset manager. And it was clear that you need a team to do all this. And what really drove this home was I was under contract on like four or five deals at one time in terms of buying and selling. So there was just documents every day. I woke up to all of the documents I had to get around to each individual party in this transaction, all the different things I needed to schedule, all the different dates I had to track, all of these different things. And for like 30 days, literally all I did was coordinate five transactions, and I did nothing to grow the business. And I was like, yeah, like, what am I doing? Someone else has to be doing this, right? There's a cap on how big you can get. So I think that if you look at real estate as a business and look for spots that you can outsource some tasks, whether it's to a third-party vendor, like a mortgage broker or a bookkeeper or something like that, or you can hire internally, I think that's going to be helpful, right? And the way I look at it is, if one person's salary is $80,000 a year and they help you do one more deal a year, like, it's paid for, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I think that mindset shift is like critical to make. So to get to the second part of your question, which is what book or resource I'd recommend, the book Who Not How by Dan Hardy. Is it Dan Hardy?
Yeah, I just read it.
You just read it.
Dan Sullivan.
Dan Sullivan. Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah. And Dr. something.
Yeah. I think Hardy. For some reason, I'm thinking Hardy. But Dan Sullivan, yeah, I think he runs Strategic Coach, a massive like entrepreneurial mastermind group. But it is a paradigm shift. Once you start thinking about who can do this, not how do I have to do it, I mean, your whole game changes. So that was a great read for me. And that kind of set me on the path to going down that road. And now as I've started to bring people on the team, again, like, I'm learning stuff on the fly. I've never had a W-2 job in an organization. I don't even know what happens on a weekly basis in a company. So I'm like trying to figure that out on my own. So Traction was the other book that I read. That was amazing. Gino Wickman. And that's basically just, here's how you run a business. Like, just do this and you'll run a good business, which is exactly what I needed. So Traction and Who Not How were the two big ones, but start with Who Not How. That's the one that you should start with for sure.
Yeah. Traction's a little drier, but it's
like a textbook.
Yeah. No, it literally is. It's something you're going to highlight and take notes. No, those are two great books I love. And I just want to thank you for your time, Axel. I know you're a busy guy and I'll have to come down to Boston soon. We'll have to kick it. Yeah, but man, I really appreciate your time. Before I let you go, where can people find you? Because I know they're going to want to.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I appreciate you having me back on. And yeah, we got to get you down to Boston here soon. But where people can find me, so my website is Aligned, R-E-P, short for AlignedRealEstatePartners.com. If you want to get on our email list, I don't blast it with junk. We send out some really good newsletters, AlignedREP.com/invest. If you want to contact me, Axel, A-X-E-L, at AlignedREP.com. And then Multifamily Wealth is the Instagram account, which is where I'm really active. And then the Multifamily Wealth podcast. So any of those avenues is probably a good place to reach me.
Awesome. Yeah. And that newsletter is solid, everybody. I get it every month. Solid detail. And he does not blast you like some people I know.
I'm like, you know, two emails a month is the most that I want to hit a list with. And I'm like, I got to bring value in all of them. So
it's great.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I appreciate it. I spent a lot of time putting them together.
No, I know you do. I'm about to start one. So I've how much work it is, so and how it will be every month.
Yep.
No,
just
man.
The podcast, labor of love. That's what it is.
But it is rewarding. It is. I will say that. But man, thank you so much for your time. I'm probably going to be down in the next few months or next month or two, so I'll hit you up. But as always, it's fun getting on here with you and going back and forth.
Absolutely, man. Appreciate you having me, and we'll catch up soon.
All right. And listeners, as always, thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Hey, this is Sean Winslow. After being in the financial service industry for years and having candid conversations with good people just like you, I realized that so many of us are wanting an investment strategy that provides solid returns and consistent income without the bumps in the road. There's little known secret that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. There is investment out there that is less volatile and the returns are stronger. Get more details by going to greenbriercg.com and clicking on the free e-report. And by the way, if this show has provided you any value, then feel free to leave an honest written review and of course share it with a friend who needs it. See you next week for another great show.